This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. security officials say that they are taking every precaution to guard against an attack on President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration Wednesday. As preparations for the day continue, the FBI is screening thousands of the National Guard members assigned to Washington, D.C. to provide security for the event. Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny is demanding free access of media to the court, hearing what she called the highest degree of lawlessness, and lashed out at the president, Vladimir Putin, accusing him of throwing the criminal code out of the window in fear. Navalny was detained at a Moscow airport Sunday after flying home for the first time since he was poisoned last summer. Later, a Russian judge ruled that Navalny should be held in custody for 30 days until February 15th. The World Health Organization chief says it's not right that younger, healthier adults in wealthier countries get vaccinated against COVID-19 before older people in poorer countries. Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus kicked off the WHO's week-long executive board meeting by lamenting that one poor country got only 25 vaccine doses, while more than 39 million doses have been made in nearly 50 richer nations. He says that the world is on the brink of a moral catastrophic failure in assuring access to vaccines. The WHO chief also raised the issue of profits that drug makers can make in richer countries. Coronavirus deaths continue rising in nearly two-thirds of American states as a winter surge pushes the overall toll toward 400,000 amid warnings that a new highly contagious variant is taking hold. As Americans observed the national holiday Monday, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo pleaded with federal authorities to curtail travel from countries where new variants continue to spread. This is VOA News. China is dealing with coronavirus outbreaks across its frigid northeast, prompting additional lockdowns and travel bans ahead of next month's Lunar New Year holiday. The country reported another 118 cases Tuesday, with 43 of those in one province, and another province just out Beijing saw 35 cases. Beijing reported just one new case, though some residential communities and outlying villages there have been placed under lockdown. The International Energy Agency says oil and gas companies are not doing enough to reduce the release of methane, a potent source of planet heating emissions. A report published Monday by the Paris-based organization found that estimated 10% drop in methane emissions from oil and gas companies last year was largely due to lower production amid a global decline in demand due to the pandemic downturn. It warned that the amount of methane released into the atmosphere as part of the production process for fossil fuels could rebound again as economies recover. The agency called on countries and companies to do more to plug those leaks. The premier of Canada's oil-rich province of Alberta wants U.S. President-elect Joe Biden to give the Canadian government a chance to make the case for the Keystone XL oil sands pipeline to be built. The Alberta premier, Jason Kenney, says he will seek legal damages if reports are true that Biden plans to scrap the pipeline on his first day as U.S. president. Biden's plan is outlined in transition documents seen by Canadian media outlets. He has previously said he will cancel the pipeline altogether. First proposed in 2008, the pipeline has become emblematic of the tensions between economic development and curbing fossil fuel emissions. Israel's education minister says that he is banning groups that call Israel an apartheid state from lecturing at schools. The move targets the country's leading human rights group, after it began describing both Israel and its control of the Palestinian territories as a single apartheid system. You know, the explosive term is vehemently rejected by Israel's leaders and many ordinary Israelis. Yoav Gallant announced the measure on Twitter late Sunday. A rights group, B'Tselem, said last week that while Palestinians live under different forms of Israeli control in the occupied West Bank, blockaded Gaza, annexed East Jerusalem, and within Israel itself, they have fewer rights than Jews in the entire country. That's including Israel proper. Find more at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America and James Butte, Washington. Today is Tuesday, January 19th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ugandan authorities have restored some internet access after a five-day blackout.
Disinformation about election had started with the intention to undermine the credibility of the results. We knew that if we did not shut social media, most likely we would have gone into chaos.
Human Rights Network for Uganda Journalists welcomes calls for an investigation into alleged election irregularities. Zimbabwe arrests over 9,000 since March for COVID-19 rules violation. A judge in Zimbabwe grants bail to an opposition spokesperson. Amnesty International is concerned over the deaths in prison of four Guinean opposition leaders. And Malawi's president announces new lockdown measures as COVID-19 cases surge.
This year alone, a total of 5,091 people have tested positive for COVID-19 across the country, showing a sharp rise in infections and a lapse in prevention.
And the impact of the coronavirus pandemic on this year's World Economic Forum. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ugandan authorities restored some internet access on Monday after a five-day blackout during last week's election that saw President Yoweri Museveni re-elected to a sixth term. The opposition National Unity Platform Party has said it will challenge the results. The opposition also says the military has their party leader, Robert Chakulai, popularly known as Bobi Wine, under house arrest. Halima Atumani reports from Kampala.
Around 10:30 a.m. Monday, Ugandans had their mobile phones ping for the first time in 5 days since the government shut down the internet. However, social media platforms such as WhatsApp, Twitter, and Facebook are still offline and can only be accessed via the virtual private network. Government spokesperson Ofwono Opondo says social media was high on the list of possible threats to the election. He says officials regret the inconvenience, but says they took the right decision.
Disinformation about election had started with the intention to discredit the election, with the intention to intimidate, with the intention to suppress voter turnout, with the intention to spread hate speech, abuse of candidates directly, abuse of political formations you don't agree with, to undermine the credibility of the results. We knew that if we did not shut social media, most likely we would have gone into chaos.
National Unity Platform leader Robert Chagulanyi, better known as Singer Bobi Wine, is contesting the election results, citing ballot box stuffing and other irregularities. The government says the NUP will only be allowed to contest the election results through court. Wine's lawyers say they have enough evidence to present to judges, but need their leader to advise on the next course of action. However, as they attempted to see him Monday morning at his home, lawyer Benjamin Katana says they were blocked.
Bobi Wine has challenged the results that were released by the Electoral Commission. And what that means is that there are several options available to him, including going to court. To reach at that decision, he needed to consult his lawyers. And it is his right to access lawyers. They have not allowed us to enter.
Police say the heavy deployment around Wine's home is because it is one of the locations that are considered trouble hotspots. Fred Enanga, the Uganda police spokesperson, says intelligence agencies have received word of possible violence.
Of instigating riotous situations and demonstrations in protest of the outcome of the elections. That's how you find that we have maintained a security cover around Kasangati and Magere. The movements are being controlled. It is not that people have been blocked, lawyers and so on.
President Yoweri Museveni was declared the winner of last week's election. Official results showed him beating Wine 59-35%. Museveni's National Resistance Movement Party also won a majority in parliament with 316 seats. However, the National Unity Platform was able to capture 56 seats, defeating several ministers in the Museveni cabinet. Godba Tumshabe, a political analyst, says the loss of the ministers, including the vice president, is a strong sign of no confidence in Museveni and his government.
Because it's unprecedented that you can have an entire cabinet swept off. Museveni has been timid to reform his cabinet. Now the voters have helped him to reshuffle it. The mere fact that all his ministers have lost, we should even be asking, how did Museveni win?
A government spokesman says this is a natural trend in the elections of Uganda, with ministers losing big because voters want other people to come and enjoy the same position. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
The Human Rights Network for Ugandan Journalists is welcoming calls by the U.S. State Department for an independent and thorough investigation into allegations of voter irregularities during the Ugandan elections. Uganda's Electoral Commission declared incumbent President Yoweri Museveni the winner with 58.64% of the total votes cast. Main challenger Robert Chakulahi, also known as Bobby Wine, of the opposition National Unity Platform Party, came second with 34.83%, but Wine has rejected the results as rigged. Robert Sempala is the executive director of Human Rights Network for Ugandan Journalists. He tells viewers Peter Clotty that the outcome of a thorough and independent inquiry into the elections will determine if the polls were credible.
We would really need to be very crystal clear about what transpired during the election, and as such, we would be able to say this was free, fair, and credible election, or to say authoritatively that it fell short of the requirements of such an election. And as a country, would be handed with an opportunity to go back to the drawing board and do a few more things to improve our elections going forward. So I would really sympathize or agree with all voices that call for an investigation into the poll that happened. Also, there was no internet, so we have, of course, the results now, the final results declared, but in that light, you cannot be sure how the results were transmitted from the countryside to the National Tallying Center.
Robert Chagulanyi or Bobby Wine and his National Unity Platform say they have evidence to show that the elections were rigged. But do you think the evidence they have will have any impact, possibly, on the outcome of the elections?
We know that being a national organization in outlook, NUP and its leader could have plausible suspicion of how the elections were conducted, and as such would be certainly very happy to get any pieces of evidence to that effect. Because like a lawyer say, who he alleges must blow, I think the task and the onus is on Bobby Wine and the team to bring forward such evidence.
Where does the NUP go from here, particularly with their rejection of the outcome of the elections? Some people are saying if they go to court, they are unlikely to succeed based on precedent. What do you say to that?
Yes, they have roundly rejected the results, and that has been put out ably by their spokesperson, their secretary general, and their principal, Bobby Wine. They certainly have, betting on the pieces of evidence that they say they have, which we have not seen generalized in the public in Uganda here. But Bobby Wine is still under house arrest. Certainly, our biggest fear is that it might culminate into chaos when his sympathizers and supporters are trying to pressure government to release him for him to take participate in the post-election process, but also as a party leader to campaign for his members ahead of the remaining three sets of elections for local governments, for municipalities, for councillors. I think their main now preoccupation is to win the remaining sets of elections, also to clear any doubts as to how results came out. That would be their preoccupation. I'm only not sure how this is going to manifest, because there's a lot of heavy security deployment in the city and in the countryside. So there's going to be a lot of confrontation, certainly, if this matter is not well handled by the government in Uganda here.
Robert Sempala is the executive director of Human Rights Network for Ugandan Journalists. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Kampala. A judge in Zimbabwe on Monday granted bail to opposition movement for democratic change, MDC Alliance spokesperson Fazai Mahere. She was charged last week with publishing or communicating false statements prejudicial to the state. Mahere had posted on social media a widely circulated video which shows a baby allegedly killed by a police officer's baton while strapped to its mother. The officer had been enforcing the country's COVID-19 lockdown rules. Rose Hanzi, director of Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights, says the bill came with some conditions.
The conditions are that she is supposed to pay 10,000 Zimbabwean dollar, the real-time gross settlement currency, which is equivalent to 100 US dollars. And then she's supposed to report to the police a certain number of times a week. And then there are also usual conditions that they normally place on bail when they grant someone bail, like not to interfere with witnesses. So there are a couple of usual conditions that they normally place on everyone else. And the difference normally is the amount of money that one has to secure their release. And in this case, she's paying an equivalent of 100 United States dollars.
We know that she was arrested and charged with publishing or communicating false statements prejudicial to the state. Did she enter any plea?
She did not necessarily enter any plea yet, but before the case was heard, her lawyers raised a concern to the magistrate where they were saying that the crime that she was being charged with was non-existent, in that they believed that the Constitutional Court had declared that provision of the law to be unconstitutional in other cases that took place in 2014. So she didn't raise any plea at that stage.
What has become of the mother whose child supposedly was killed by police? Have you heard anything from her? What has become of her?
We haven't heard anything from that mother, but a few days after Mahere was arrested, there was a certain mother who was interviewed by one of the state broadcasters about that story. And basically, the person who was being interviewed was claiming that she was in good health, the child was in good health, none of them had been killed. But of course, it's very difficult for us to confirm or not to confirm whether that was the same mother.
Rose, thank you so much again for speaking with us on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you for the invitation.
Rose Hanzi is Director of Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights. She was speaking with us from the capital, Harare. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, January 19. Authorities in Zimbabwe say they have arrested over 9,000 citizens for violating COVID-19 rules since the country's first lockdown began last March. Zimbabweans are still struggling to comply with the regulations. Reporter Kuzai Nevashe has more from Harare.
Dr. Agnes Mahomba is the leader of the National COVID-19 Task Force.
People are just not appreciating the seriousness of this disease at all. The complacency continues. The large numbers of people being arrested is a true testimony to the fact that people are not listening. We have mounted a blitz on trying to communicate, but remember, behavior change is one of the most difficult things to bring about. We saw that with HIV, it took so long. So we just have to keep plowing and working on it to get those behaviors to change.
She adds that the media has a role to play in raising awareness and pushing for behavior change. National Police spokesperson Assistant Commissioner Paul Nyati highlights some of the offences they have noted among perpetrators.
The most worrying concern is the issue of people not wearing masks, the issue of unnecessary movement.
Nyati says attitudes must change for the fight against the coronavirus to succeed.
The issue of attitude, if you go around the high-density suburbs, you find people are drinking beer in street corners. And when they see the police and services, they play hide-and-seek. People want to be forced to wear a mask. Why should somebody be forced to wear a mask? Why should somebody wait to be arrested to wear a mask? It is for the health of everyone else. As long as people are taking the issue of COVID-19 for granted, then we have a problem in terms of enforcement, terms of preventing the pandemic. People should play ball.
Critics say while attitudes should change, some people who are mostly in the informal sector have to choose between feeding their families or staying at home. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashi from Harare.
Malawian President Lazarus Chakwera has introduced new lockdown measures to contain a jump in confirmed COVID-19 cases and deaths. The restrictions include closing schools, a nighttime curfew, and no gatherings over 50 people. Lamek Masina reports from Black Tire.
The measure comes 5 days after President Chakwera declared a state of national disaster in response to the recent spike in COVID-19 cases. The new measures, he said, are being enacted because the situation is getting worse in the second wave of the pandemic.
This year alone, a total of 5,091 people have tested positive for COVID-19 across the country. This means that of all the people confirmed to have contracted the virus since April last year, 43% have been found with the virus this year alone, showing a sharp rise in infections and a lapse in prevention.
Chakwera said that so far this year, 111 Malawians have died from COVID-19, an average of 7 people per day.
This means that of all the deaths from COVID-19 in the past 9 months, over a third have happened in the past 16 days, showing a sharp rise in fatalities.
To reverse this, Chakwera ordered that all schools to be closed for 3 weeks, except for students currently doing certificate of education examinations. Chakwera also said all learners in boarding schools must be screened for COVID-19 before they go home. The Minister of Education disclosed Monday that out of 605 students at one girls' secondary school in Lilongwe, 311, or just over half, have tested positive for coronavirus. As for the lockdown measures, the president ordered markets to be closed at 5 p.m. and drinking establishments to be closed by 8 p.m. He said no one should be on the streets between 9 p.m. and 5 a.m. and banned gatherings of over 50 people. Benedicto Gondowe is executive director for the Civil Society Education Coalition. He argues that closing schools should be the last option.
Schools were closed for not less than 7 months during the first wave of COVID. And we even registered unprecedented numbers of teenage pregnancies in excess of 40,000. And that's why we are saying, could there be a mechanism of mitigating and containing the virus while schools are still in session?
Gondowe says government should devise a plan that allows some learners to continue with their education.
We do not know for how long COVID will remain with us. If COVID takes 3 years, 5 years, and you are seriously saying that education should be suspended, what future will we have created for generations to come?
However, George Jobe, executive director for the Malawi Health Equity Network, commends the new measures. He advises Malawians to strictly observe all restrictions for the sake of their own health and not wait for police to enforce them. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Four opposition leaders and their followers have died in Guinea's prisons after more than 300 people were arrested during and in the lead-up to last year's presidential elections. Amnesty International researcher Fabian Ofner tells Ricky Schreier that the authorities have yet to take responsibility and the situation is worrying as President Alpha Condé enters his third term.
So far, most of these activists are still in prisons. Trials are organized in the last days. Some other are already scheduled for the next days, especially the one of Umar Sila, a.k.a. Fonike Menge, who is one of the main leader of the FNDC, was arrested and who have been was been detained for weeks only because he participated to a banned demonstration which has been banned in violations of the international law, because it's important to recall that even before the COVID-19 pandemic, most of the demonstration of the opposition were forbidden. So all these opponents are still in prison so far. So the situation so far is still worrying, and detainees are dying in prison right now.
What do you know about the four detainees who passed away in prison? Was it due to neglect or mistreatment, or do you have any details as to what the cause of death was?
We have some details regarding the first one, Ibrahim Asso. He was quite an old man who was arrested after the political violences in October. And according to the authorities, he died at the hospital after he was brought out his cell. But what we as Amnesty International have been able to report, thanks to pictures of his wrist, notably, and pictures of Ibrahim Amso, is that he suffered some ill treatment within the prison. It's not clear whether it was from the prison authorities or from other detainees, but what is almost sure is that he not only died of diabetes, like the authority says. The last one who died 2 days ago, Mamadou Ouribari, there have been some interviews in the press explaining that his mother alerted the authorities because he suffers some pain.
What does this say about Condé's third term in office, do you think, in terms of how political opposition will be dealt with from the security forces and from a freedom of speech standpoint?
We will see. We're still waiting for the new government to be appointed. But the situation right now in Guinea, it's still very worrying. You know, all the demonstrations have stopped. Dozens of people have been killed during the demonstrations. So there are no more demonstrations so far, political demonstrations. The opponents are whether in prisons or they fled out of Guinea. So what we see now in Guinea is it's fear, you know. People have been detained. People fear to go in the street to demonstrate because they might be killed and they might be wounded. So this first year, the beginning of the first year of the new Alpha Condé, if we can say, it's quite worrying.
That was Fabienne Offnon, a researcher at Amnesty International. She was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Dakar, Senegal. The shape of life after the coronavirus will top the agenda of next week's annual World Economic Forum. The event will be held virtually and not in the plush Swiss ski resort of Davos as in years past because of the pandemic. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The glitz and glamour of political and business movers and shakers rubbing shoulders in Davos will be gone this year. But this has not deterred world leaders from popping in and out of the forum's virtual gathering. More than 1,500 business, government, and civil society leaders from more than 70 countries are expected to participate in an exchange of ideas on the new global situation emerging from the COVID-19 pandemic. The executive chairman of the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab, says 2021 will be a crucial and pivotal year for the future of humankind. He says it will be crucial to create sound economic growth that is resilient, inclusive, and sustainable in the post-pandemic world.
But what we have to do above all is to restore trust in our world. Trust is needed in order to overcome the crisis, but trust is needed as a base to have a future-oriented mind and to construct the world for tomorrow.
A high-profile cast will present its views on the policies and strategies needed to drive a recovery from the social and economic devastation caused by the virus responsible for the COVID-19 disease. Heads of state set to address the forum include China's President Xi Jinping, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and South African President Cyril Ramaphosa. Heads of United Nations agencies, financial institutions, and CEOs of major corporations also will speak. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that's it for this Tuesday, January 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.